reading it off. Just being dutiful.
Got to get everybody on the same page.
Good morning. My name is Travis Stearns. I'm here on behalf of Alex I, and I would ask for 3 minutes.
Okay.
So this is really, I think, one of the first opportunities that this court has to address the question of confessions and statements made by juveniles since JBD versus North Carolina was issued. JBD versus North Carolina is a landmark case. It recognizes that children often feel bound to speak to questioning when an adult would not. It requires the court to determine what legal protections must be provided to a child during custodial interrogations, and requires the court to make a clear analysis of whether a reasonable child felt pressure to submit to questioning. It's really an extension of the Eighth Amendment cases that this court has done a lot of analysis on, that starts with Roper, and really almost takes almost the same analysis and moves it into the question of whether confession should also be put forward. Now, here, I think that the trial court failed to address the additional protections required and failed to account for Alex's age in analyzing whether this statement should be suppressed. I want to go through some of those and talk about why I think that the sufficient protections were not put into place and why the court failed to make those particularized findings. First, I think it is important to recognize that the officer had no independent memory of the warnings that were given to Alex. So we didn't hear, as is typical, and although I don't think necessary, but typical, we didn't hear what the warnings might have been. But more importantly, we didn't hear anything about what, or he didn't say what his warnings might have been. And I think perhaps more importantly, we heard that he said that he provided juvenile warnings to Alex, but didn't say what those were. And I think that is also a critical issue. We don't know whether he followed what might have been standard, especially because he had no independent recollection of what the Miranda warnings were in the first place.
Well, you say we don't know that, but the trial court found that it happened.
Yeah.
So where does that put us?
Well, so I, of course, challenge that finding of fact. I think that if you look at the record from about 121 to 123, you can see the testimony of the officer who said that there were no independent findings. I think that if you look there, you'll agree that the findings of fact that the trial court issued with regard to that are not based upon the record.
Well, didn't the officer have the opportunity to refresh his recollection by looking at his report and then testify?
He did look at his report and testify. Again, he said he had no independent recollection, and he provided no testimony as to what the warnings were. Again, we assume that those warnings were probably the Miranda warnings, but there's no testimony that those were exactly what they were, and they certainly were not in that police report either. So I think that beyond the idea that, and again, I would urge the court to focus more on what the juvenile warnings might have been.
Well, he in his report, he said he gave him the juvenile warning.
Right.
We are in juvenile court. There was no objection that I recall from the record that juvenile warnings had not been given based on his refreshed recollection.
You're absolutely right. One of the other things that I think is also starkly...
How are the juvenile warnings different from the adult warnings?
Well, so again, typically the juvenile warnings are going to be more expansive if they are the case. And certainly I think that part of what the court should be thinking about is where juvenile warnings need to be post-JBD and whether... And again, so it's a very challenging question because youth has to be taken into account. You have to talk about what the special protections are, but of course they're going to be very different for an 11-year-old than they are going to be for a 17-year-old. And I'm not sure.
Well, aren't they standardized? I mean, that's what
yes.
That's what the court's referring to. They're not particularized. They're standard.
Yes, but I think that JBD does talk about there needing to be, again, an accounting of the reasonable child and a question of what the reasonable child would have said with regard to whether a reasonable child would have submitted to questioning. under the circumstances.
Well, and that's, and the court does address it. I mean, that's age, and then we have English proficiency. So those were two factors that the court addressed that were issues raised below.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the question of whether his will was overcome and whether there was coercion.
Right. And I think that there are a number of factors here that suggest that there was coercion. One of the more disturbing sections, and of course the trial court found...
Well, before you talk about that, could we just go back? You're citing this case, JDB, and
yes.
You're citing the Roper line of cases, and you're saying that there's some issue that arises out of those. What is it? What is the problem here that, in other words, if we were writing an opinion that you want us to write, we would say, well, this violates JDB and Roper, what would it say?
That the court did not take into account the special protections that are required to determine whether or not a child's statements were coerced.
And what are those?
Well, that, of course, is a real problem with JDB, because JDB sends it back down to the trial court to make a determination of what those special protections are. And that, I think, is a real challenge with respect to JDB. And,
well, how are you going to meet that challenge? Are you saying there are certain protections that should have existed by any reasonable person who was aware of JDB? And they simply weren't used here? Or who should have used it, the officer, the judge?
The court needs to have made that finding, and I think that that is a requirement. I think that that is the clear answer out of JDB.
So here the court should have made a finding in its findings of fact and conclusions of law that the interrogation that was conducted here satisfied JDB.
Yes.
Was the court asked to make that finding?
That, of course, is a standard. That is, I think, part of the constitutional analysis that is required. I think that that is a clear directive out of the constitutional analysis.
I don't see how it can
analysis.
Be if there is no content to it. You know, if you're not going to tell us what you think should have happened differently, and that what happened here violated it, and those particular facts were brought to the court's attention. I just don't know what you're talking about. It seems to be a content-free argument.
Again, it's challenging because JDB doesn't...
Well, it's challenging, but it's also content-free. Do you agree with me that it's a content-free argument?
Now, I think there are a number of factors that a court could look at to determine whether or not the special protections were there. I think that if we had known...
What are they?
Well, for example, I think that giving the child the opportunity to speak to their parent, which was not clear here, giving the opportunity... not using the coercive language that the police officer used, telling him that he needed to man up to be a man, and that men make confessions like this. I think that those two are clear examples of special protections that need to be provided to a child. You can't use this sort of coercion and be satisfied that the special protections were there.
Thank you.
Oops.
I just meant we're really done.
I'm
struggling with this thing today. Morning.
May it please the court, Ann Summers on behalf of the state of Washington. I believe the primary issue here is whether there's substantial evidence to support the trial court's finding that the statements were not coerced and, in fact, were voluntarily made. This is a totality of the circumstances test. The state has the burden of proving it to the trial court by a preponderance of the evidence. And there are many circumstances in this record that support the trial court's conclusion that this was a voluntary statement. First of all, the evidence at trial, and in fact undisputed, was that Alex was in fact Mirandized by Sergeant Soljan. And that's corroborated by Sergeant Soljan's
given juvenile warnings.
Yes, and given juvenial warnings. And also...
Off the top of your head how juvenile warnings differ from the...
I'm sorry, I don't. It's not in the record, and I don't personally know.
You don't know anything about... I mean, are they new? Are they old? Are they uniform? Are they given to every police officer?
I'm afraid I...
You don't know anything.
I don't know anything about them.
So, I was in juvenile court. I didn't like it, but I was there.
So the recording shows that Alex fully understood what the officers were saying to him, and that he answered all the questions appropriately.
That had to do with the findings related to English proficiency.
But it is part of the totality of circumstances
right.
as to the voluntariness.
Right.
There were no promises made to Alex, and in fact, the officers explicitly said, "We're not going to make you any promises."
Well, I think they're focusing on the man up.
Yes.
statement, so you may want to focus on that.
All right. He was, well, just to go through, this was not a long interrogation. The entire contact from the time he was stopped, the time he was dropped off at his home was approximately an hour. He was not squirreled away in some tiny, scary interrogation room.
Well, he was in a patrol car.
Well, but yes, but that's because they had been shooting at cars. In addition, the Miranda warnings, which say you have the right to remain silent, the officers explicitly told him, you don't have to talk to us. If we're done talking, that's fine. We'll go back to our work. I'll go back to my coffee, which is getting cold. There were no threats made to Alex whatsoever. And basically what the officers did was urged him to take responsibility for his actions, to be respectful and honest. And I think it would be a sad statement of our society if we were said that was unnecessarily coercive.
Do you think that's the only interpretation of what Officer Jensen was telling him?
To urge
him to take responsibility as opposed to an implied threat?
I can't see an implied threat here whatsoever. Implied threat to what? I mean, I don't imply threat. They basically
to
say,
man up and tell the truth.
That's just take responsibility for your actions is what my understanding of what man up means.
Well, he explained it. He, Officer Jensen, explains what man up means.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to man up and talk, tell me the truth, or are we done talking? Because it doesn't say stupid across my forehead. I've been a cop long enough. I've been an adult long enough. I can read through lies. If we're done talking, then fine. I've got other work I can do. But if you want to start owning up to what you guys were doing and start taking responsibility, this is your one opportunity. And Alex says, if I tell the truth, then what? To which Officer Jensen responds, then you tell me the truth. And we go from there. I'm not going to make you any promises. I'm not going to tell you, oh, if you tell me this and that, I'm going to let you go, because I can't do that. What I'm going to tell you is that if you tell the truth, we'll treat you a lot nicer. We'll work with you with what we can because you're trying to man up and be respectful. But that's up to you. I just don't want to waste any more of my breath. I've got a coffee in there that's getting cold, so if you want to talk to me and tell me the truth, I'm happy to stand here and listen to you. If not, I want to get back to my coffee. That was the interrogation. It's certainly, now remember, this is a...
What about the interjection of the unidentified officer after he says, man up, and the officer says, well, he's only a kid?
So persuasion is not coercion. I mean, as the court recognized in JDB, any police interview has a coercive aspect to it. That's why we have Miranda warnings. So the police are trying to get him to take responsibility for shooting up people's cars. Yes, they're going to try to persuade him to tell the truth, but that is not coercion that overbears a person's will under the Due Process Clause.
So we've heard the argument that JDB requires special consideration of the juvenile.
It requires, and actually I don't think JDB is some huge sea change. I mean, the law has long recognized that juveniles are different. In fact, we have an entire juvenile justice system that's entirely different from the adult criminal justice system. If you look at Galt in 1967 from the U.S. Supreme Court, Fair v. Michael C. from 1979 in the U.S. Supreme Court, Doodle from 1980, all dealing with juveniles. Those cases go on at length about how juveniles are different and how age needs to be considered.
But the law about how you can take confessions has, you know, it still allows. I remember a case some years ago where the police went to this fellow's house in the middle of the night, woke him up. He was juvenile. Not allowed to talk to his parents, interrogated. I mean, you know, there was no recognition there. Particularly that this was a younger person. I think the argument was made on appeal, and I think that's what's happening here too. Is that all those cases galled the entire juvenile justice system? Yes, juveniles are treated differently, but I think your argument has to focus on what is the law of confessions, of taking, of interrogating. Is it different? And I mean, I guess just to throw you a little softball here. I mean, it seems like the judge here did have that in mind because his comments go into the course examines the respondent's age. There's no evidence that the respondent was unable or had difficulty understanding it. I guess there's no specific comment here about, well, I thought about whether I should let him call his parents, but I decided not to. I mean, I guess that's one thing that counsel has suggested could have happened.
So this test has long been a totality of the circumstances, and the suspect's age has long been considered one of the important circumstances to take into consideration. And I don't think it's new to think that what may be coercive to a 13-year-old is not necessarily coercive to a 30-year-old. Here we have a 17-year-old who was very near majority, but JDB, the question in JDB was whether a 13-year-old should be Mirandized when he was being interrogated by a police officer at his school. Okay, and the question was, is that custody? Is being in a little conference room with a school administrator and a police officer custody? And the court said, when you're figuring out what an objective, whether the person would believe they were free to leave, you need to take into account age.
Well, and here he's in custody.
There's no question he's in custody. The court found that he was Mirandized, which helps significantly with the voluntariness analysis. And yes, his age is a factor, but you can look at, you don't have to take anybody's word for it. You can actually read the words of what was said to him, and this was not so coercive to overbear his will. Certainly the trial court has substantial evidence from which to reach that factual finding. And unless we're going to say that, well, we can't question juveniles at all, and you can't ask them to tell the truth, because that's just way too coercive for someone who's 17 years old, which I don't think the law is going to go there.
Isn't it true that in Britain you can't interrogate a child without their
parents? I have no idea.
Well, I mean, it's not such an outlandish thought.
Well, no, but it's not the law, and there's no authority that that's the law in the United States.
Well,
and for a much younger child,
suggesting we should make it the law.
But well, it would be a totality of the circumstances. But again, the question is, and I don't think there's even any dispute what the law is. It's a totality of circumstances question as to whether what happened overbore this person's will. And if you look at this, he's clearly making, what happens, he starts to deny, he's initially denying anything, knowing or having seen anything. I was driving, I didn't see anything. And they talked to him for a little while, and he says, well, if I tell the truth, then what? And they said, well, then you tell the truth, and we'll go from there. And he clearly is making a rational and responsible decision, and that's what we want people to do.
So are there any analogous cases that you think would be helpful to look at?
No. I mean, there's lots of cases. There's Broadway.
With juvenile.
Juvenile cases. Well, the juvenile cases go all the way back to Doodle from 1980, where juveniles over 12. And again, they said it's the same test. It's totality of the circumstances. And one of the really important circumstances is the person's age and experience. But again, I don't think you can say that no substantial evidence supports the trial court's conclusion in this case that Alex's will was not overborne by inherently coercive tactics, other than asking him to take responsibility. If you have no further questions, thank you.
So I agree there's not really a clear path forward and that there aren't cases that can tell you the answer to the questions. I think that it is important just to begin by starting from just a couple of lines earlier from the piece of testimony that Ms. Summers read. Start, unidentified officer, he's a kid, so he doesn't know what being a man is. And every time Alex stepped back from making a statement, some sort of a similar statement was made that you need to man up. And I think that when we're analyzing this not from the perspective of a reasonable person, but as a reasonable child, which I think that JDB. Thank you. JDB says is that the reasonable child analysis has to be the one that the court analyzes this question from. And when you
what are you pointing to in the court's findings of fact and conclusions of law that would lead us to conclude that the court was not applying that standard?
I don't see a finding of, I think that the court needs to have made that explicit finding that they were analyzing this from the point of view of a reasonable child, and I just don't think that that analysis was done in this matter. I think that that really is the critical question that that the question of whether a reasonable child would have submitted to questioning under here is the question that needs to be answered. And I think the answer, like I said, have said, given what we have here, which I think is beyond just simply a child sitting in the back seat of a car, but a child who has potentially heard his cousin being threatened with breaking his arm, an officer who is found to be not credible with the question of whether he coerced the cousin, his difficulty in being able to speak English, his statement, "I want to make license," and really the testimony from the officer that he had some difficulty speaking to him, the no memory of whether he had questions regarding his Miranda warnings, the number of times that he was told to man up during this. And then,
I think it was twice, wasn't it?
Well, I have it here that he speaks regarding not knowing what a man is at RP 30, then at RP 34 he doesn't know what a man is, and then a man would tell the truth. Yes,
yeah.
So that's probably twice.
It is twice. Yeah. I mean, I think he says man up, then the unidentified officer says he doesn't know what that means. He's a kid, and then the officer says, well, he goes on and then goes through man up again.
I'm sure you're right. That looks like I'm sure you're right. The other fact I think that you can look at is the implied threat that the car was going to be impounded, that he could help his parents by telling the truth, and then again, finally, that there was no memory of any questions that Alex might have had. And these, I think, present the difficulties, and I think that under these circumstances, you should find that a reasonable child, or that the constitutional rights of this reasonable child were violated. Thank you.
Thank you.